Well, it's about 7. So let us begin when in Isaiah, the 17th chapter. If we are able, we'd like to get chapters 17, 18, and 19 tonight, but there's a good chance we won't be able to go that far. In the 17th chapter, we have a description given of a prophecy to Damascus. And this prophecy to Damascus really is including also Israel. Because at this time, Israel and Damascus, or we might say Syria, Damascus was the capital of Syria, Samaria was the capital of Israel. So Israel and Syria were entering into an alliance make war against Judea. Well, God didn't intend for Israel or for Syria to destroy Judea. And so if they entered into alliance then between themselves to destroy Judea or to make war against Judea, they were really going to be working against God. And so this prophecy is designed to show them the doom that's going to come upon them as a result of this alliance that they've made. Because Judea, the king there at this time was Ahaz, and later on Hezekiah, Judea made an agreement with the king of Assyria, this Tigrath-Pileser, who then became their protector and also became the arch enemy and the destroyer of Damascus and Israel. So it begins by saying, the burden of Damascus. And you know this word burden here means the prophecy. This is the prophecy that the Lord's going to lay on Damascus now. Destruction, the doom that's coming upon them. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Now, this is thought to be about in the fourth year of Ahaz. And as we stop and think about the city of Damascus, the historians say that it's the oldest city in the world today. It's located up in the northernmost part of our map of Palestine. It's up above Palestine, really, in the northern area there, on a parallel with Tyre and Sidon, but it's over just above the line of the Jordan River. And there was a river that, there is a river that runs through Damascus, and this river is so efficiently used and so well divided up into canals until it very effectively waters this plain of Damascus. And they say that there were numerous gardens and orchards and areas where fruitful plants were grown in and about the city of Damascus. They were watered by this river that ran through there. And the water was so efficiently used until after it passed through the area of Damascus, it just ran out into kind of the sandy desert and disappeared. It ceased to even be a river. And without this river, though, Damascus would have lost a lot of its usefulness and beauty. But it was one of the great wonders in this whole area at the time that it was flourishing. And as I understand it, Damascus still exists today. But it's even spoken of in way back in Genesis in the time of Abraham. And it's thought to be the oldest city in the world today. And so as he talks about the destruction of Damascus, he doesn't say that it's going to be completely annihilated like he did Babylon, but that it would be brought down and destroyed, but yet it didn't mean that it would never exist again as a city. So he says, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. And it was destroyed by the Assyrian army, and it did cease to function. But Damascus was at one time under the rule of the Jewish people, and then it traded hands, and it's been ruled by several, but it's an old and very enduring city. And the cities of Aurora are forsaken. Now, nobody knows exactly what the cities of Aurora are. It's thought to be a province or a possession of the area of Damascus, and then it would mean the cities around about there would be forsaken. Remember now, Damascus was the head or the capital of Syria. And Samaria was the capital of Israel. And whoever controlled the capital city, you know, pretty well controlled the nation. But the cities round about it would be also forsaken, so that this would be not only a destruction of the city, but of the country itself. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So these cities were going to be so well forsaken and uninhabited that there'd be a place like a pasture where flocks would be. Flocks would go there and lay down, and there wouldn't be anybody around to make them afraid, so they could animals could live there in perfect ease without the fear of humans. That's how these cities would be made. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim. Now, as we study about Israel, and we have the name Ephraim applied to it, it reminds us of what we studied last Sunday in Hebrews 11, in which Jacob blessed the two sons of Joseph, and he blessed the younger son, Ephraim, by putting his right hand on the younger son, and the older son, he put his left hand on Manasseh, so that Ephraim had the greater blessing, and Ephraim actually became the strongest or the leading tribe of the 10 tribes of Israel. And so the name Ephraim is used in the place of Israel. The fortress shall also cease from Ephraim. Now, a fortress is a well-fortified area, probably a city or a principal city or the principal areas of habitation. It'll cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. These two countries, Israel and Syria, would have vast destructions done upon them, and certainly it did happen. At this time, a major part of Israel was carried into captivity by the Assyrians, and then later the city of Samaria was besieged and completely destroyed, and then another captivity was made. So he says that the kingdom would cease from Damascus and the fortress would cease from Ephraim, indicating that these two places would cease to function, these two nations would cease to function as a power in the world. And the remnant of Syria. Now the remnant of Syria would be those people who were left in Syria after the city of Damascus and the cities of Aroer were forsaken or destroyed. The remnant that was left, they also would be taken from or cease to be. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. Now the glory of the children of Israel was Israel, and there were the 10 tribes. And so if they were going to cease to be, if they were going to be carried into captivity, so then also would the remnant of Syria be like the glory of Israel. Both nations would be treated the same. And the reason here for this is because these two nations entered into an alliance. They entered into an agreement among themselves that they would make war and oppose Judea. Well, today, if God's children enter into an alliance or an agreement with ungodly people, particularly to carry out ungodly actions, then they can expect no better treatment than the ungodly people have. They're going to get the same kind of treatment. And so he says here, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. They're going to be treated the same. And in that day, it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. Now the glory of Jacob, of course, is another term for God's people, for Israel, here called the glory of Jacob. Of course, it was the offshoot of Jacob, Jacob's 12 sons and their families constituting the tribes here at this particular time, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom. But he says they shall be made thin. That is, they're not going to be flourishing or prosperous or have even enough to eat in the figurative or maybe even the literal sense of the term. And the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. He's going to be poor, in other words, not really able to thrive and flourish and prosper like he ordinarily would. And it shall be as when the harvest man gathereth the corn and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathereth the ears in the valley of Rephaim. Now he depicts this as all that's going to be left here is going to be like a place whenever the harvest man comes in and gathers the corn. Now, the word here for corn is what we generally talk about today as maize. That was the type of grain that it was, more like what we call maize. But the two words are similar words. Initially, they claim that the corn we have was also called maize, and that's why this company that sells Maizola calls theirs Maizola, after the name of maize. It's really corn, but the corn in this passage is really the thing that would head out like we'd call maize. Well, it's going to be as when the harvestman gathereth the corn of the maize and reapeth the ears with his arm. And notice the word arm is in the singular there. And the way they would reap this is he would take his arm and put around it and then take the other hand and cut the head off. Or grab a hold of it with one arm and cut the head off with the knife in the other one. And it shall be as he that gathereth the ears in the valley of Rephaim. Now, this place known as Rephaim was really a fruitful valley near Jerusalem that was very productive in the things planted there. And so it's simply used as a figure here. Speaking of gathering the harvest, to speak of this valley of Rephaim would bring to everybody's mind a big, bountiful harvest. Well, as these countries were taken into captivity and their people were hauled off or led off, they use the term led. I don't know if they were led or driven, but they were taken off. It would be just like a great harvest coming. And the only thing going to be left is just what the harvest man happened to miss. And, you know, a man who's getting the harvest doesn't want to miss anything if he can help it, because it's money when he misses part of the harvest. So, in verse 6, yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. Now there would be some left. There would be a little remnant left, but he said it would be just like the gleaning grapes that would be left in it. Now, when they harvested the grapes, just the ones they just happened to overlook, the ones they didn't see, or it'd be like as the shaking of an olive tree. They shake the tree and get all the olive berries that they can, but yet there may be two or three berries in the top of the uppermost bough. The very top branch might have something they just couldn't reach, and so finally after shaking and trying, they may go off and leave those. That's the way it would be left here as the remnant in Israel whenever they were carried away into captivity. Four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord God of Israel. Now, the outmost fruitful branches would be those in the lying way out, hard to reach, and maybe the outer reaches of the country, not in the beaten path of where the armies would come, they might be left. Now, verse 7. At that day shall a man look to his Maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. Now, if there was any time ever that was going to bring these people to God, it was going to cause these people to really seek the true and living God and become devout and religious people in the true sense of the word, that would cause it to come about. And so he says that one of the effects of this is going to be that at that day shall a man look to his Maker. He's going to start seeking out God on that day. He's going to look to his Maker. He's going to look to God. And his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. He's going to start showing some respect for God, for the things of God. The thing here called the Holy One of Israel. And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands. Neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. Now he's not going to look to the altars. He's not going to have respect to that which his fingers have made, or the groves. Now the groves would be the places where they had these altars and where the idolatrous worship had been carried on in the past, and they took it up after the people before them, or the images, which would again be the really idolatrous things. And these people were given over to worship. Now they did worship. Maybe they didn't worship in the right way, but they certainly did worship. And God condemns them for giving the wrong kind of worship. And I'm sure today that as God should look upon this nation and see the many, many different kinds and various times and forms of worship that are given to the so-called supreme being, that this nation couldn't be accused of not worshiping, but it can certainly be accused, as these people were, of not worshiping in the right way. When this great calamity came, they'd stop looking on these groves and on these images and on these things made with their hands and on these altars. In Hosea 8, verse 11, he says, "Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin." Now the statement there about Ephraim, which is the nation we're reading about here, Israel, they made many altars to sin. And so, he says, altars shall be unto him to sin. Because he misused these altars, then an altar would be a symbol of sin for him. Every time he worshipped, he was sinning. And so really, when you speak of an altar, so far as Ephraim was concerned, you're speaking of sinning. That's what Hosea says. Then again, we read in 2 Kings 16, verses 10 through 13. And this is an account of when Ahaz went up to visit this man known as Tigath-Pileser, and he saw an altar, and let's notice what happened. Verse 10, "And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tigath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah, the priest, the fashion of the altar, and the pattern of it, according to all the workmanship thereof." Now what happened? Ahaz went up to visit his man that he had an alliance with, Tigath-Pileser, who was really his protector, up at Damascus, this city that had been captured and was to be destroyed. And he saw an altar there, and he liked the altar so well that he sent the pattern of it, he sent the image of it, back to his priest. He sent the fashion of it back to his priest at home so he could make an altar like it. And Urijah, the priest, built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah, the priest, made it against King Ahaz, came from Damascus. And when the king was come from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached to the altar and offered thereon, and he burnt his burnt offering and his meat offering and poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offering upon the altar. So we see here how the king there in one instance sinned with an altar. He saw an altar that was made by heathens and used by heathens, and he liked it so well that he had all the plans sent down to his priest. He had one made just like it, and as soon as he got back, he offered worship upon that altar to God. So they made altars and they sinned to the point that altars became sin to them. And the lesson I think that the world today fails to see in this is that just any kind of worship will not do. It may be a better, more superior form than what we've seemed to have in the past. It may seem to be something new and innovative. It may be that which is recognized by the high powers of other nations or other educated persons, but it is not what God has given, and consequently, God will not receive it. So that day, he says, a man shall not look to the altars, nor to the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. These things are going to pale into insignificance whenever God starts placing these judgments upon the people. Now in verse 9, "In that day shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation." Now this verse has created a lot of difficulty in interpreting and applying it. But what it means to me is, it's just about the same as if you went in and cleared out a thicket of trees, and in your haste to clear it out, you would occasionally leave a tree behind, maybe a small tree, maybe an uppermost branch in one of the trees. You'd leave an occasional one behind. So it said, "His strong city shall be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel." Now they left them. The true wording here should be in the face of the children of Israel. But they left them because of the children of Israel. That is, God no doubt intended for some remote cities to be left so that the remnant that was left behind would have a place of a fortification, a place in which they could sustain themselves. So he left it because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation. Now, the rest, everything else was destroyed according to this. So just an occasional place was left, so rare and so occasional, until many of the histories of this time do not record the leaving of the remnant. The only way we really know that the remnant was left is what we read and glean from the scriptures. And this is an interesting thing, because as we study about the 10 tribes, and man has called them the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and they want to say that every last person was carried out, nobody was left, and so now the 10 tribes are lost. But whenever we stop and see that there was a remnant left, then they no longer become the 10 lost tribes, but they then are just the remnant which God was to use later to carry out His purpose for Israel. So there doesn't have to be a returning of 10 lost tribes from distant most parts of the earth to accomplish what God needed to accomplish with the remnant. That would be the coming of the Messiah and the establishing of the kingdom and the witness about the throne of David. Now, verse 10, because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength, therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants, and shalt set it with a strange slips. Now, this verse is a little hard to interpret, and there are several interpretations of it. But the basic premise of the verse is that they're going to have some real problems with their prosperity, because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation. So what happened here? These people went about their activities and having forgotten the God of their salvation. Well, what were their activities? What did they do? Thou hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Therefore thou shalt plant pleasant plants and shalt set it with strange slips. Indicating that they would go ahead to plant their fields and their gardens. They would plant the good plants, what he calls here pleasant plants, and they would set it with strange slips. Now, a slip is a piece of a plant that you would plant into the ground. It wouldn't be the seed, but it would be a portion of the actual plant that you would put into the ground and cause it to grow. Now, strange slips would mean these slips that came from foreign countries. And there's two ways to look at this. One is that they were valuable, important, or so much care wouldn't have been taken to have imported them from another country to plant to get the most choice kind of produce from it. So that's one view, is they planted the good plants and the strange slips, that is the imported slips, to get the very best. Now another view is that because you have forsaken God and the rock of thy strength, then you've gone about to plant the pleasant plants, that is the things that would just give you pleasure in this life, and you have gone into foreign countries and imported from them their plants, their kinds of worship, their altars, their idols. And this is a result of you having forgotten God. There's two ways then to look at that. Excuse me. But the results are going to be the same. Verse 11. In the day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish, but the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Now, it's going to grow all right. These plants are going to grow. They're going to flourish. These strange slips, these imported slips, they'll grow, they'll flourish. God's going to let it happen. But when the harvest time comes, that's where the problem's going to be. When it comes time to harvest, then there's going to be a heap in the day of grief. And another translation says, then shall it be removed in the day of harvest. The plant's not going to be there. You're not going to get to reap your harvest. And we see today, you know, those who are worshiping God in the wrong way, those who have forgotten about the strength of their salvation, and they go about their own ways, they seem to flourish. They seem to be getting along and thriving quite well, just as these Israelites were. He says, you'll make your plant grow, and in the morning shalt thy seed make thy seed to flourish. It's just doing so well. But when it comes time for the harvest, and God is then ready to intervene, and see what kind of real true fruit you are producing. If they're fruit from a strange slip, then he says that it's going to be a heap in the day of grief, or that is, it's going to be removed in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Deadly sorrow is another translation for this. It's going to be terrific sorrow whenever time should be to joy and rejoice at the harvest. Verse 12. Now in verse 12, we change to a little different slant of the prophecy now. The first 11 verses have been about the doom or the destruction of Israel and Damascus. Now as we get to verse 12, this seems to be talking about God's prophecy concerning the invasion and the sudden overthrow of Sennacherib. You remember we studied about him and his army last time, the Assyrian army that he was the descendant of Tiglath-Pileser, and times now had gotten to the point that the Assyrian army was a threat to Judea. And as they got right down on the very doors of Jerusalem, within 3 or 4 miles of the city of Jerusalem itself, and right there at Mount Zion, then God, by his mighty angel, caused 185,000 Assyrians to fall in one night. He turned them back. Sennacherib went back to his home country, and there he died. Well, this seems to be a prophecy about that, beginning in verse 12, the last 3 verses of this chapter. Woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. Now, this is a description of a mighty army, a vast number of soldiers now. He describes them as the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of many of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushings of mighty waters. This army had been a very victorious army. And you remember whenever Hezekiah was praying and pleading with God and saying, "Our God will protect us," that Sennacherib sent him a message and said, "Well, look at all the countries we've overcome. We've captured country after country," and he named those countries. He said, "Their gods didn't help them any. They worshiped these idols. They had a lot more elaborate idols than you have, and they didn't help them any. And so what good your God going to do you?" And so this was then like the rushing of nations. "The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters. But God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind." Now on the one hand, we have these armies depicted as being an irreversible, unstoppable force. What are they like? They're like the noise of the seas, like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations, many of them, a great noise, a great turmoil, and the nations rushing like the rushing of many waters. But whenever you pit that strength, as formidable as it may seem to be, and it certainly did look that way to Hezekiah, when you pit that strength, though, against God, then look how the picture reverses. "But God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind." They're just going to be like the chaff that the wind's blowing around. That's how much force they're going to have against God. None. While the chaff doesn't slow the wind down any, you could have a wind blowing and throw all kinds of chaff into the air, and the velocity and speed of the wind wouldn't change any. It doesn't even slow the wind down. "Like a rolling thing before the whirlwind." It's just like a whirlwind that's going and rolling something before it. "And behold, at eventide, trouble." Now this may be referring to the night that angel did come and kill those 185,000 Assyrians. "At eventide, trouble. And before the morning, he is not." That is, this army was completely decimated. It no longer existed. It was no longer a threat. Just overnight, it ceased to be. "For the morning he is not." This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. That's what's going to happen to those who spoil us, that is God's people. Those who spoil God's people, this is what's going to be their portion, what's going to be their lot. This is what's going to be meted out to them. And so we see in this chapter a great warning.